For you, what is the most puzzling about human nature, the most difficult to explain? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, host and study guide author for our discussions this quarter on life everlasting, on death, dying, and the future hope. I'm Professor Emeritus of Biblical Studies from Walla Walla University School of Theology. My conversation partners, Jody Washburn and Dave Thomas, are also from the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Welcome to both of you. Now let's take that leading question. What is the most puzzling thing about human nature?
I think that the thing that rattles me most often has something to do with the sense that we're sort of built to be self-centered in one way or another, whether or not we have, maybe it manifests as having the sense that everything revolves around us, or maybe it manifests as the sense that we have to, in order to prove our worth, demonstrate that we are somehow at a higher level, right? That could be a sort of a hierarchical ranking, and we need to make sure to be okay to be in the upper, you know, levels of that ranking. And it just troubles me that comes so naturally, and yet it's destructive. Mm-hmm. And I understand we can be unpacking, you know, those things throughout our life.
I think to me the most puzzling thing is the ability we have to bifurcate life, that we can create these ideal theological systems and yet behave badly.
Mm.
And feel and not feel like there's a
disconnect.
Yeah, it's not disconnected. As long as my theological world is good, and I do quotation marks perfect, then even if I behave badly, sometimes extremely badly, I mean, you read about very conservative churches where the social misbehaviors, the rate is very high, the abuse of children and spouses, and yet the theology is very strong and perceived to be, mm-hmm. You know, if your theology doesn't affect your living, I don't know what to say about it.
There's a very vivid example of this that came out recently, and that is Philip Yancey's memoir. He came out with a memoir entitled Where the Light Fell, I believe, and he paints scenes in that book where he, for instance, he says, our home growing up could have been a Christian bookstore. Our magazine racks were filled with the voice of prophecy. We had the Bread of Life Bible memory cards in the shape of a loaf on our table, and we pulled one out at breakfast every morning. And yet, at the same time, they would be beaten, prefaced by, do you know what they did to disobedient children in Deuteronomy? They stoned them to death. And there was a lot of pain. And he's open that the pain of his mother had roots, right? She just didn't get up one day and decide, I'm going to be abusive. It had roots. It was tied to her own story. But the fact was that there was this disconnect between her as a Bible teacher at church, where everyone thought everyone was perfect, and then the way that things went, mm-hmm. in their home.
Yeah, but you see, if you're highly authoritarian, what do you do with people who misbehave?
It's a threat.
You know, I think this is the source of some spousal abuse. If a husband is supposed to be in the head of the house and his wife is not behaving properly and she doesn't respond to conversation, what do you finally do? The same thing with children, you know. And I mean, growing up, I used to play once in a while with a boy who would get spanked on Friday at 3 o'clock every Friday afternoon, so he would behave on Sabbath.
Ooh.
And so, unfortunately, that idea worked in reverse because he figured it already paid his dues. I remember being quite shocked when his father came out of the house on Friday afternoon and said, all right, come on. And the kid started crying, and he said, no, we're going to go take care of this right now. And he went back to the shed behind the house, and you hear whack, 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 and the kid cried and said, now you behave yourself tomorrow. And then he came out to play, you know.
Wow. I'm learning the dynamic, not what you just described, but going back a little bit, the dynamic that someone else needs to comply or obey or behave in order for me to feel okay about myself. This is, in essence, a wounding. Like, this is acting out of a wounding. But
it's creating a wound.
And it's exactly, that's my point, is that when we can't talk about it, when we can't be aware of how that is coming out of a wounded place, we pass it on generation after generation.
Yeah. To the third and fourth generation.
That's a mercy. Goes farther if God doesn't
that's a mercy.
Nudge.
Oof,
the...
I never thought of it that way.
Now, there's
Abraham was the father of three generations of liars. They learned their lessons well, I think.
Yeah, we internalize those messages deeply.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at Jacob, I mean, his name when he was born was basically cheat.
Yeah.
And it was a remarkable story with Jacob when his name was changed. He wrestles with the angel. And names have meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Jacob basically means he who grabs the heel or cheat. And so...
And Israel means?
He who wrestles with God.
Yeah.
And I would like to back up, you know, thinking about the story of Jacob. We talked an earlier week about the... sort of innate desire we have to decide, like, all right, all wrong, evil, good, and to pile this up, you know? And there's the famous quote by Solzhenitsyn, we wish we could pile up all the good people over here and all the bad ones, get rid of the bad ones. Well, he goes on to say that the line between good and evil runs right down the middle of the human heart.
Yeah, it does.
And in the story of Jacob, I think what's so important, because one of the shame responses that I feel like shuts people off from thinking about, why am I looking for validation through the compliance of my children, is that we think that that would make us a quote-unquote bad person. If I admit this, then I am admitting that I belong to the pile that is labeled bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if we think of Jacob and the fact that he put his head on a stone long before his name was changed. And the presence of God, right, was basically, I always imagine this as beamed down to that place on the stone where his head was. And he had this, what we could call an epiphany, that I am running away. I am estranged from my own family. And yet, God wishes to be with me. Long before the name change, long before he's the father of what would become Israel. And that, this is what we need to come back to ourselves as humans who pass on trauma from previous generations.
Yeah.
To be able to say, yes, I hurt you. And I believe God is present with all of us.
Well, the way we work with our children is really quite remarkable. I'm thinking here of when I performed the wedding for my younger daughter, who now lives in Italy. She told me, "Don't you get close to crying, Dad? Because if you break down, I could too, and I don't want to shed any tears." So as I prepared the service, I deliberately put in things that I thought might be a bit funny to keep down the temptation for tears. And in one place, I remember saying, you know, one of the most amazing things was when Steve, who was marrying her, came down into my study and asked permission to marry my daughter. I said, I was so astonished because I can't remember the last time Krista asked permission for anything. And one of my colleagues said, someone took him aside and berated my colleague on my behalf, that how could a father actually not insist that, but I knew my daughter.
Yeah.
She did the yearbook over at our academy here, and she would stay down there all by herself in the empty academy building, sometimes till 4 or 5 o'clock. I knew that that was a very dangerous thing to do. But if I told the Academy. She was clever enough to put that together. And that tendency to be strong-minded. I mean, we raised our kids. We never laid the law down. Mm-hmm. They had freedom. And that's dangerous. But I chose to give them freedom rather than to see them rebel.
Is it dangerous, though? Or is relationship inherently risky because the relational space between you and me is created by me and by you? Therefore, I only have control over what I contribute. I don't have control over what you contribute. But when we allow that space to come and be, you know, influenced by both parties, that is what relationship is.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's risky, but that's also where life happens.
Yeah.
But I also think there's a progression that has to be acknowledged, because a little baby, you don't just give freedom to.
Mm-hmm.
A two-year-old, you don't just give freedom to.
But you do respond relationally.
Yeah, you do.
When they express a need, you respond. So so you are mutually.
Yeah, yeah. You're not discounting them. But, I mean, if you give too much freedom, then parental influence just disappears. And I think there should be some parental influence.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you don't have the switch that controls what your child does. And I've noticed that parents who have children who, in their mind, go bad, they blame themselves. You know, like, I must have done something wrong. No, your child has the capacity to choose what they are going to choose, even if it's contrary to what you had hoped for. So I don't think it rests primarily with parental influence.
Well, my wife has an interesting story that she tells when she was growing up. She took some crayons and wrote on the white wall in the living room. And she says, I got spanked for it. And she says, I don't know why they spanked me. All they need to do is tell me not to do it again. See? But if everyone in the world was like my wife, we would have no courts, need policemen. But not everyone is like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really quite intriguing for us to actually have to deal with that. Well, there's one more thing I'd like to tuck in. We've wandered all over some exciting stuff today. Is that the question of where do we go when we die, according to the Bible? Downstairs.
We fall asleep.
We fall asleep.
We lay on the tomb of the bench next to our fathers, whose bones have been scraped off into the little holding tank next to the next to the family tomb bench.
That's physically what happened.
That's where the Alden has this question, right? Why does the Old Testament describe people as laying down or resting with their fathers? It's very literal.
Yeah.
Based on the tombs.
Well, Jody, time has passed, so we must bring this to a close. To sum up, we've explored the tension between the perspective of Genesis 1 and 2. Didn't really take time to do that. The first chapter in Genesis portrays a majestic God who creates by the spoken word, not touching anything. But Genesis 2 balances the picture by presenting a very personal God who molds and shapes the humans with his own hands. Now that was prophetic what I wanted to do. We got chasing other things. My thanks to Dave Thomas, to Jody Washburn, my conversation partners, and to Kristen Byerly, our program engineer. Each of you, thank you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.